Hello, everyone. Before I show you the episode that we are talking about today, I just wanted to briefly say this episode is shorter than normal for reasons like 100% out of my hands. Teachers listen to this podcast, so they know that certain seasons in the teaching year is very... They're busy. Every 2 seconds, you're called to a meeting, things like that. And everyone knows that we're real teachers doing these podcasts. So we get things that get blocked up, and I have to move things around to get certain people on the podcast. Sometimes I have tons of episodes just waiting to get released, and sometimes I'm right there in the end because of rescheduling and whatnot. And this is one of those times. I'm literally recording this on February 13th, the day that I'm going to release the podcast, and it's just the world I'm working with. Teachers, you know what I'm talking about. You just work with what you got, and you do the best you can with all of the millions and millions of things people ask of you. So, I just wanted to say, it is a short episode, but it is awesome. I have to get Siobhan Mulligan back on the podcast because she has so many good things to say. Hopefully this episode rings true for you, and it's exactly what you need to hear right now. We have another great episode coming up in the next 2 weeks. I feel like the podcast is really just starting to take off. Our listenership is skyrocketing right now. Something's happening. Word's getting out. So thank all you guys for sharing this with your teams. Listening, every time we release an episode, just seems like there's more of you. I'm seeing more of your faces on the Facebook page. It's awesome. Thank you for that. Anyway, I'll stop talking. I just wanted to kind of preface this episode with that. All right, enjoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Teach Me Teacher, a podcast for educators, where we, the teachers, become students ourselves. I'm your host, Jacob Chastain, and today I am speaking with Siobhan Mulligan about how poverty affects education and our students. Welcome, everyone. In a stunning turn of events, I'm not recording on a Friday. We're actually recording on the Monday you're going to get this podcast because of technical issues, or not technical issues. We had a million meetings last week. It threw everything off. It's all good, but in good fashion, I'm not letting you guys down because I know you're waiting for the podcast episode, right? We just got in our eighth country of people listening. So everyone's waiting. So I'm here putting in the extra work on a Monday right after all of my classes. And the good sport, Siobhan Mulligan, welcome to the podcast, first of all.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
Hanging in.
How was your day? Was everyone, any crazy kids today?
Isn't that synonymous, kids, crazy? In the best of ways, of course.
Yeah, and we're in February. And kids are starting to act like it's February. We're getting later in the year. I feel like I'm having more, they're starting to come out of their bubbles, right? I teach sixth grade, so they're like, oh, we're going to turn into seventh graders slowly, right?
I've got sixth, seventh, and eighth graders. And the biggest change I have seen, honestly, is in my eighth graders, who seem to be developing maturity earlier than I expected.
Yes!
Yeah.
That's good. That's good news.
It's very good. It's very good.
Yes. We're going to go ahead and get right to everything just because tighter schedule today, but poverty in the classroom, this is the thing that I feel like is on a lot of teachers' minds right now, especially with, things going on, with our government and what certain policies mean with certain things. We're not going to touch on the political side of this necessarily, but I know you have a keen insight into how poverty affects schools and student achievement and whatnot. And I really wanted you to get to highlight your views on this. But before we get to any of that, I just wanted you to tell our listeners, who you are, what you do currently. That way they know who they're messing with. And I just didn't pull someone off from the street and say, hey, you want to be on a show?
Well, it's interesting because most of my adult life was spent in the book industry. I ran bookstores for years.
I did not know that. That's awesome.
Yes, that's part of the reason why I'm into our reading program so much. I've always been a reader, and I've always enjoyed kids. And while I was managing the bookstores, I wound up doing foster care for about eight years. Had, oh, I would say at least 100 children through my home in that time period.
Wow.
And the ages ranged from a couple of days old up to a 13-year-old, who actually later became my daughter when she was 15. But in any event, it gave me a real up-close and personal look at what poverty in particular can do to our kids. And when my company that I worked for went out of business and I was faced with having to find a new career, I decided to go into teaching. And actually, the first job I landed in, because of my foster care background, I believe, was teaching emotionally disturbed kids.
Mm.
And once again, that was not only showing me the personal effect for the students, but also how it affected them inside the classroom. Because the biggest area you see this effect in is in their executive functioning. And executive functioning is something that we work on with kids starting, unfortunately, in some cases, starting in kindergarten.
Sure.
We're trying to get them honing that executive functioning. And the ACEs, also known as adverse childhood experiences, the ACEs really take a hit on that executive functioning.
That's it. What got you to do the foster work that you were doing?
My parents fostered young mothers when I was a kid.
Oh, and you just kind of fell in,
well,
fell in line.
You know, ever since I was a kid, I've always felt like one day I would be called to adopt. And literally, I did five times. Had to stop fostering because this inn was full.
Sure. So let's, you know, for a clarification of definitions, right? Always helps to go into a conversation having a clear idea of what we're talking about. So when we say poverty, when we're talking about poverty with you, what is the definition that we're really working with in terms of our students that we're seeing in the educational community throughout the United States and other countries and whatnot?
Well, I think for me, poverty comes down to a lack of safety and security for the children. And when I say safety and security, I mean they may not necessarily know where they're going to be sleeping that night. They may not necessarily know if they're going to have food. I think one of the toughest students I had was a third grader who would come to school every day and just beat on his mother. He did not want to stay at school. Took me a while to find out, but as it turns out, one time he came home from school and she wasn't there. She'd been arrested.
Man.
I don't know if he wound up having a place to stay, but when you think of a child that age and the constant that mom is in your life, it's your lodestone. It's what supports everything. And she wasn't there. With no answer and no explanation. A lot of these kids, when you're talking about the uncertainties that come with poverty, that's what I see as being the damaging part, is not knowing, not having any real sense of control of their lives.
And I feel like there's, you know, one thing that I've learned just over the last few years of teaching is, you know, it's not always that obvious of to which ones are these types of kids. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many times, you know, you make a phone call home and you realize, or you have a parent conference or a conference with a grandparent and you realize there's a whole different situation than with this kid. So they don't always, these kids with these situations at home don't always just announce it, you know, in the class based on their behavior. Sometimes there are these kids that are just, it's just like that, and they don't really show any outward behavior necessarily.
Well, and for a lot of the kids, they don't realize that it's unusual.
Yeah.
It is what it is. It's what they grew up with. And uncertainty, one of the most commonly misdiagnosed conditions is ADHD. And what it is misdiagnosed with, what it gets confused with, is anxiety. So you have kids, these kids who are having this uncertainty of where are they going to sleep, who's going to be at home with me, what kind of a mood are they going to be in, what kind of food, or are we going to have food? That creates an underlying sense of anxiety in these kids, mm-hmm. and a adrenaline constantly going through their system. And if you try and think of a time in your life when you were either really excited or really scared, and think about what pattern your brain went through, it's basically like the Energizer Bunny. Mm-hmm. Just zip, 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 zip. Looks like ADHD.
Sure.
So these kids can wind up getting diagnosed with ADHD, maybe being medicated, et cetera. But really, the true underlying issue has nothing to do with a chemical imbalance of ADHD variety, but it has to do with that adrenaline that is constantly running through this child's system. They may not have ever learned how to self-soothe. You have kids that can wind up with high levels of anxiety because their mothers were anxious and were stressed throughout their pregnancy, again, because of poverty-related issues.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that makes its way to that fetus. It makes that way to that developing infant. And once the infant is born, once again, what are the stress levels like in the home? How secure is mom and or dad feeling? And, you know, again, it's that early interaction with the adult that teaches a child how to go through that cycle of arousal and down into contentment. Mm-hmm. And if they don't get that, or they don't get it frequently enough, then you have a child that's always in that arousal state. And that does not allow for a whole lot of thinking, a whole lot of reasoning. And most importantly, it does not allow for that executive functioning, that point where they are able to prioritize, that they are able to plan, that they are able to analyze information that they're being presented with at school.
So do you think, you know, as an educator, when you're looking at a child who is clearly having trouble focusing on something, and it could look from the outside like it's an ADHD issue or something like that, and they might even already be labeled, you know, ADHD in the system, do you think it's especially challenging for the educator, or rather especially important that we take the time to try to figure out what's happening at home before we just blame it on, you know, oh, well, they have ADHD, so clearly, you know, this is doing that. Do you think, you know, just from the educator's standpoint, that we should, if we have kids demonstrating those symptoms, that we should try to figure out what's happening at home first, or?
I don't know that it's so much, because, I think what it comes down to is, I don't know that we can afford to figure out the whys. I think what we have to do is respond to what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what it comes down to is it's important that whether it's ADHD or anxiety, the reality is this child has a huge difficulty with focusing. And it's not something that is necessarily their fault. You can't say it's because this kid doesn't want to do well.
Mm-hmm.
The kids all want to do well, but they are not able to for whatever reason. So if we understand this child has difficulty focusing, there are any number of things that we can do, things that are kind of foundational to teaching that a lot of us don't even realize that we learned early on it was smart to do anyway, such as having procedures in place.
Sure.
Being very automated in terms of the kids know. They know what to expect. They know what's going to happen next. They know what happens on Mondays. They know what happens on Fridays. That does a lot to help a child feel secure. There are some other things if you're in a high poverty area, such as having snacks on hand, believe it or not, making sure that the students are getting a chance to drink mm-hmm. or to eat a snack every 2 hours. That helps keep the arousal level low for them.
So to you, what are some misconceptions that teachers have, or maybe not necessarily teachers, but just people in general? What are some misconceptions we have about students in poverty?
I don't know that there's necessarily misconceptions about the students in poverty. I think there might be some misconceptions about some students in general, such as, you know, some students might be lazy. Some students might be too hyperactive.
Yeah, right.
Some students might not care. And I think it's those assumptions and misconceptions that make us miss the fact that some of these students don't function the way they function by choice. They function the way they function simply by necessity.
You know, I think that's kind of... I went to a Kagan training. I'm pretty sure I've talked to this on the podcast before, but when I was at training, there was one line that stuck with me ever since, you know, I went and sat in those, you know, 4-day seminar or whatever, and they were talking about kids with behavior problems, you know, whether it be disruption or, you know, pick whichever one you want, right? And he goes, every child that does something that they're not supposed to do in a classroom is showing you a need.
And a lot of it is survival.
Yeah.
It's survival based, you know, whether it's deflection. Whether it is not wanting to be caught doing it wrong. You know, we don't know what kind of environment. Yeah. And I'm not suggesting that the environment is necessarily abusive, but it could be a sensitive child does not want to disappoint their parent. And so the last thing on earth they want to do is to be wrong. Yeah. And so they're going, you know, they're going to find ways to not have to do it.
Yeah. And that comes out in, you know, all kinds of variety of ways, right?
Absolutely.
Like every teacher listening to this, they just have to sit back and go, okay, so what do the kids do today? And you could pinpoint it, right? And you might not know the reason, but it didn't really matter. It's just the fact that there's a reason they're acting like that, right?
There absolutely is. There's a reason, and whether, like you said, it's a need that has not been met, or for me, it is a survival tactic. And so I have to identify what part of them is in survival mode.
Yeah. So let's talk really about, like, you know, what does poverty do to a school? In a school where, you know, it could be a heavy population of students in poverty, or they could just have, you know, a small selection of students. Either way, it's going to affect the environment of a school one way or another. Could you tell us just a little bit about How does poverty really affect schools in general? What's going on?
Well, I think when you talk about schools in high poverty areas, you are talking about schools that are having to, as you said, meet many more needs than I think the average American realizes.
Yeah.
That we're having to meet.
And again, I'm going to take that and put a quote right there.
I mean, I don't think that they realize how many of those needs and necessities. I mean, I can remember having one young man who was my student. I had a horrible stench, to be quite honest. And I finally was able to pinpoint it down to his feet. And it wasn't that they were unclean, they being him and his family. Mm-hmm. It was their access. Their access, whether it was just to wash the tennis shoes. And I remember bringing in Scope, you know, mouthwash, and pouring a basin of water and mouthwash so that this boy could soak his feet and get rid of that smell so that he wasn't embarrassed. He would act up because he did not want to leave the classroom because he knew he smelled and he didn't want anybody responding to it. One of the other teachers went out and bought him a pair of tennis shoes while I was soaking his feet. Those needs, I can guarantee you, in schools that have more economic stability, I don't know that the teachers would be facing that kind of reality.
That's a unique thing to public schools, and why public schools is so important is because as schools, we serve the kids that we get, right? We don't choose one way or another, you know, and it's what we get. And in schools where you have people that aren't necessarily in the most comfortable of living environment, whether, you know, be mom or dad or whoever, right? We deal with these really unique problems, and they're never the same.
Mm-hmm.
And there's such a variety of them. And then depending on the size of your student body, right? It just multiplies.
And what's interesting, I think, we're specifically speaking about poverty because poverty, it is far more prone towards childhood trauma. But the interesting thing is all the studies they've done on I should take a step back. I apologize. I think of it as trauma versus poverty. Trauma can be found at all socioeconomic levels. And that's where you see the kids, and I don't care if it is a school in a high-income neighborhood or a school in a low-income neighborhood, you're going to see kids acting with that inability to cope, that inability to self-soothe, that high arousal in any school because of the fact that these adverse childhood experiences, if you look that up on the web, you will have millions of hits. Trust me, it's fascinating reading. But that hits at all different levels. The challenge I feel like, because all I've done is work in high poverty public schools, is that uncertainty and that feeling of constantly needing to protect your resources or keep an eye out for your resources and for your resources to disappear. Again, going back to that high level of arousal.
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to have a place to stay? Do I have to share my bed with three or four other people, which means I'm not going to get a good night's sleep? I have a student this year that we offered to check out. He's got a learning disability. Offered to check out an iPad for him to use at home. He doesn't want to take it home because there's so many people there. He's afraid it would be damaged or broken. He can't assure himself, much less the school, that it would remain safe. Mm-hmm. So he chooses to not make use of something that we were very lucky to have and mm-hmm. to be able to offer to our students. But he's hesitant to take us up on it and to help his own education because there are so many people living where he lives, he's afraid he can't protect it.
That's crazy. Crazy in the sense that it's just like, you could imagine, right? I mean, or you can't imagine just being in an environment where you'd be literally, you're scared to do something that benefits you,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an incredible thought. And why, you know, you briefly mentioned, you know, it's, a lot of people don't know like how much resources, how much time, how much effort that it really takes to like help these types of communities and whatnot, and really what entails it. Why do you think political correctness plays a role in why it's not aware of how much schools really have to try, how much work teachers have to put in to help these? I mean, where's the gap of knowledge? I know that's
because
a huge question.
But quite frankly, because the people who talk about schools in the press, et cetera, are not they're not people who are in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not.
Right.
You know, the people who decide what we teach and how we teach are not teachers. They don't have that background. That's been my experience.
And who decide the budgets and whatnot.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you my first impression when I first walked into the schools, and this was after being a business person, I ran districts. I ran districts in New York. These were not small little corner bookshops. These mm-hmm. were major $7 million a year businesses. And I remember looking around and thinking, oh, for God's sakes, who is responsible for this mess? Because it seemed like people were constantly reacting. There was very little proactive, where do we want to be 3 years from now? Where do we want to be a year from now? That business thinking. And I understand, like right now, supposedly, that they're trying to get a more business-minded person.
Sure.
But like I had mentioned before, until the schools at the level of the school, at the school level, has more control, more ownership of what they are executing, it's an exercise in futility. It is completely an exercise in futility. It's just constantly being pushed down the ladder, do this way with this material, what little material we even get.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's harder for schools with high poverty populations? Do you think it's harder for those types of schools to take charge of their, what being proactive, like you said, really taking a hold of where they want the future to be? Do you think it's harder for them to do that, or are all schools kind of equal playing field on that?
I think that it is harder for schools with the higher rates of poverty simply because they have less to work with. And so very often so much energy is spent in keeping our heads above water that we don't have as much of the opportunity to branch out or explore, maybe you could say.
True.
You know, this time of year, we're starting to trade kids again. I didn't think I would be there in February, but I have to tell students, you know, if you want a pencil, give me something and you can check out one of my pencils so that I can get it back. Because I've got five kids of my own. I can't afford to buy 200 or 300 pencils every couple of weeks. And, you know, that's keeping my head above water. You know, I don't have books or materials for my special ed students. You know, they read in an average of a third grade reading level, and they're in the sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. Third grade reading level, we're in a middle school. We don't have third grade reading material.
Yeah.
So I wind up having to go online. I go to Amazon and wind up buying my materials that way. And, you know, I just don't know that I would find that same level of figure it out.
Yeah, totally.
At a school that had more funds at their, and I know people, well, you know what, I'm getting way off topic. I apologize.
No, I think it's all relevant because these are the realities that people that are going to listen to this podcast, they're going to click on this episode because the title's going to say something about poverty, you know, and whatnot.
And they probably teach in high poverty.
Yeah. And, or, you know, even if they don't, they've dealt with certain situations where it's been a part of their experience as a teacher, you know, because even if you're in, you know, a more well-off neighborhood, you're going to have those kids. They're going to be in the system somehow or another. They're going to be connected to
that. Mine are. And this is a perfect example because, you know, I bought my house back when I was making $30,000 more a year than I am as a teacher.
Sure, right.
And so I live in a pretty upscale neighborhood, and I was doing foster care. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you the number of times I had to go into school to defend one of my foster kids who, you know, the other kids would look at them and you know, no matter what you try and do, they stand out, whether it's because of the way they talk, whether it's because of the way they interact with other people. There are ways at times that kids from harder backgrounds stand out.
Yeah.
And I'd have to go in and say, this is not okay. I am not going to hold my foster son accountable for this other student being scared of him because his head was shaved.
All my episodes end up talking about reading and literacy because I'm a reading teacher. And it's just the first thing on my mind all the time. But, you know, talking about student achievement, we talk about what kids are at home, what do they have access to? And a lot of these kids that live in poverty, they don't have access to books. They might have never even had a book in their house, or they weren't read to as kids. Like, these are common traits that are a part of people in poverty for whatever reason, right? They might move so much that having a bunch of books or whatever, or maybe their parents just never bought books, right? You don't know what the situation is. But statistically,
they may not have a home to keep books in.
Yeah.
But not only that, I mean, I hate to interrupt you, but I have to tell you, after being a lifelong book lover, I mean, I read an average of a book a day.
Mm-hmm.
I speed read, maybe that's not really reading to some people, but I devour books like other people devour food.
Sure.
I have a very hard time reading to my kids. I have five. I'm a single parent. They're of different ages, different ability levels. Three of them have traumatic backgrounds that they remember. They can remember not being fed. They can remember, you know, parents being gone, being alone in the house at the age of two or three. Again, we go back to that executive function and that ability to tone down and self-soothe. It's very difficult to read aloud to a child who's constantly amped, who's constantly has that adrenaline running through their system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I hate to admit it, but I don't read to my kids nearly as much as I envisioned myself reading to my kids.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, that's a quality point because even you're aware.
Single parents, yeah.
Yeah, and you're aware of the issue already. You know that their literacy is going to play a massive role in how they achieve when they get older, what they do as an adult. I mean, it plays everywhere. And you're aware of this, and it's hard for you, so we can imagine people that have no idea, or maybe they know it, but it's just not, you know,
well,
the last
thing
they're thinking about.
If you don't have a home, where are you keeping these books?
Yeah.
And where are you getting these books from?
And then you get students, you know, with third grade reading level at an eighth grade, or, you know, whatever dip. You know, we have kids that are, you know, in pre-AP classrooms that aren't reading it on level. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's just the reality of being in a type of school that we're at. And when you look at trying to get these kids to put books in their hands and try to develop that love for reading, it's a big thing.
Well, you've got to find the books that speak to them.
Yeah.
And that again is challenging because it's not like we can take them out to the local bookstore. And, you know,
and we're limited with what we have.
I mean, I used to love it when middle school and high school and even little kids, I would love it when the parents would come in and say, I cannot get my son to read. Great. Tell me what his interests are. I'll find you a book he'll read.
Mm-hmm.
I loved doing that. Can't do that without having a broad access to a large number of books, especially new releases. And that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen in the libraries that we have.
And what's really interesting is when you add in the issue of English language learners or immigrants that just got here and they're in the public school system, then you multiply the issue even more because it might be poverty, plus they're learning another language, plus, you know, whatever, you know, they might have a learning disability or something else that
goes along. Well, we don't know what they're fleeing from, if they're fleeing. We don't know. Again, I don't care race, gender, economic status.
Mm-hmm.
These traumas can happen to anybody and everybody, and you just don't know with the students that you have. You can anticipate seeing more of it in high poverty areas simply because, you know, money can buy a lot of certainty in certain ways.
So we've hit on, you know, all the things that if teachers don't know by now, they probably haven't been in the classroom long enough, or they're just nodding along saying, yep, I know this, I deal with these types of students, this is my common thing. So what do we do as educators? We have a shortage of resources. You have a million people from way up top telling you have to do all of these things. We have to meet certain criteria, yada, yada, yada. You know, schools are getting raided across the United States, right? I mean, you have all of these things that we have to deal with as educators. It's just a part of our job. What do we do? What's your advice to teachers on how to manage these things in a way that doesn't make us feel like we're failing as educators, but they're actionable steps to where we can act, you know, we can feel good about what we're doing for these kids?
I think it's almost impossible to ask this, or it would feel impossible to accomplish, but I really think forging a connection with each of your students, but especially those students that seem to fall through the cracks, whether it's because they're disruptive or they're just so quiet, really making sure that they know that you see them. You have a lot of studies right now on adverse childhood effects. Conversely, you also have some on resiliency. How do you raise resilient kids? Kids that will keep trying and not give up. We see a lot of students giving up in school. It's too hard. How do you build that resiliency? One of the most common factors was someone believed in me and someone cared. Someone was interested in what I was able to do. You know, I teach special education, and I have students that are used to not knowing. And when they do something well, I've finally gotten them to write out a sentence and it's so good, I put it on a sentence strip and post it out in the hallway. The looks on their faces of, oh my God, you mean I can do some of this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's that connection and that really making sure that kids know that they matter to us. And that's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard with 30 students, 6 classes a day. 20 to 30 students.
Sure.
That is really hard. And I don't know the answer. There's always going to be a couple of kids that slip through those cracks. And I think that's sad. But I guess my most important point to all teachers is it's the disruptive ones. It's the disruptive ones that they don't want to fail. They will seem like it.
Mm,
they will give you every indication that they would embrace failure with a wide open heart, but they're not. Something, like you said, there's a need that's not being met. There's something that's wrong there.
Of course, you said like it's really hard for those kids. I think if the more teachers are aware of this, and the more we really try to have those connections with as many students as possible in a school, then you have way more of a likelihood of blanketing the environment to where each kid at least feels cared about by that one teacher, right? If everyone's trying, then we have way more of a likelihood of success at reaching these kids and giving them at least one secure environment, one area where they can be successful, one area where they feel like their needs are met by at least one teacher.
Well, and you're teaching them what it feels like.
Yeah.
Because imagine, I used to get asked all the time, how can you do foster care? Doesn't it upset you to let, especially when you get an infant and they're with you for a year, year and a half, and then you send them off to a great aunt in Alaska? And I always tell them, but I know that infant has learned peace and contentment. She's experienced it, or he's experienced it. They know what that looks like, and that can give you hope. That can give anyone hope. If you know what that feels like, you know what it feels to feel to be secure, to be safe, that can carry you through a lot of crap in life. And when we talk about, building resiliency in kids and having that teacher that cares about you, when you've built that trust, you can demand so much more from those kids in terms of academic performance, because once you've got that trust, and once they trust that you really do believe in them, they'll give it to you.
Sure.
If they can.
Yeah, right.
To the best of their ability.
Sure. Siobhan, I am so disappointed that we can't keep going for another 30 minutes. It's, as we were recording this, I got called to another meeting, like all of a sudden, right?
You're too popular.
Apparently, I don't know what I'm doing, but people keep wanting me to go places. I'm going to get you back on because you have so much insight. It's not even funny how much my listeners of Teach Me Teacher really need what you're saying. So it's good stuff. So I just want you to know, I really do appreciate you stopping in and sharing things with us.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm not a psychiatrist, and I'm probably not even one of your more experienced teachers, but I love kids. So, we all care.
That's what this podcast is. I mean, we're real teachers doing the job, and that's kind of what that's why people are listening to it, is because it's not some expert sitting up there. We're people in the trenches learning from each other, right? I mean, this is exactly like professional development, where you learn from other teachers. That's the whole goal, was that, why do I want to listen to someone who's making way more money than me tell me how to run my classroom, right?
Yeah.
I want to know someone who has the same salary, deals with the same kids, and that way I can trust that what they're saying is true. Not to devalue, what the experts say or whatever, but there's definitely value in listening to real people talk about real problems. So anyway, I'm going to leave you at that. For everyone listening, thank you for tuning in to another episode. If you have not yet, go like our page on Facebook. Make sure to hit that subscribe button so you get every episode on iTunes as soon as it pops up. This has been another episode. Have a good one.